You're listening to the Nightlife Podcast with Indira Naidu.
In terms of engagement metrics, hype houses and SponCon, do they mean anything to you? If they don't, then probably you're not familiar with influencer culture or what indeed influencer culture even is. Well, my next guest says it's time we sat up and paid attention to the explosion in the influencer economy, which makes millionaires out of children on YouTube, propels young hopefuls to stardom on Instagram and TikTok, and inspires mums to share their lives online in exchange for sponsorship. Olivia Yallop is the author of a book, Break the Internet, In Pursuit of Influence. In it, she explores the rise of the influencer and goes behind the scenes to try and understand what it takes to make it big. And Olivia is with me now on Nightlife. Welcome to the show, Olivia.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, great to have your company. Now, for the uninitiated, how would you describe what an influencer is and what they do?
That is a very good question, because there are lots of competing definitions of what an influencer really is, whether people like to call themselves influencers. It's become a bit of a dirty word in recent years.
Yeah.
But the way that I try and define an influencer usually is just saying that it is really anyone who creates content online, shares that content via social media platforms, and monetizes their identity so their income is related to them sharing their life in this way.
All right. That's pretty straightforward. So what made you want to write a book about this in the first place?
Also a good question. There's a kind of two-part answer to this. One of them is rather silly. So I'm a millennial. I'm embarrassed to confess that I'm a millennial. And I grew up kind of really seeing the evolution of the internet. And I was personally quite involved in the early days of Tumblr. And many people who I was friendly with on Tumblr during, it was going to be probably the late 2000s, actually went on to become part of the first generation of influencers. So there's a bit of a personal connection there.
Right.
And then secondly, I actually felt that I work professionally as a digital marketing strategist and professional working in the social media industry. And I felt that although in the last decade, there's been much written and much attention given to the power of social media platforms or the power of algorithms, there actually hadn't been anything really written about those who live their lives by learning to navigate them. So I wanted to sort of redress that balance and try and tackle a subject that not that many people had really written about in this format or at this length.
All right. So, Olivia, you mentioned there that you came to this in the early days of the rise of the influence, in the early days of the internet. How would you describe the evolution of your own relationship with social media?
It's an interesting one, because I think the key dynamic over the past sort of 10, 15 years in which the term influencer has really crystallized and the concept of an influencer has become slightly clearer in people's imagination is that it's really moved from something that was originally quite fringe, quite mainstream, and definitely not something that was particularly cool, into what is now one of the most desired career paths for children. So when I began messing around on the internet and blogging and experimenting with Tumblr and various other early social media platforms, it was seen as a sort of kind of fringe thing to do. It wasn't something that particularly cool kids did. It wasn't something that was very glamorous. It was kind of, you know, you'd spend time on the internet if you didn't really feel comfortable in the real world. Of course, all these years later, you now have 1 in 5 children in both the US, the UK, and China who say that they want to be an influencer when they grow up. So this idea of being very online has really shifted from being something very kind of off the rails to being something that's very, very mainstream.
And it's happened so quickly, hasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It was really fascinating working at I began my professional career at an advertising agency, a kind of traditional one that was producing billboards and print ads and all those sort of traditional forms of advertising that we know. And within a few years, we were losing so much business to kind of new digital enterprises, to social media. And it's been crazy how in such a few years, the sort of the nexus of advertising has really shifted from being something that was really offline to something that's really online.
Now, Olivia, some people, especially those who aren't digital natives, might dismiss, you know, this whole pursuit of influence of fame as vapid or narcissistic. Why should we be interested and concerned, as you mentioned, in the rise of influencer culture?
I think there's a little misconception about influence that I'm really kind of setting out to try and redress, which is that influence and being an influencer amounts to no more than just taking selfies or streaming video games or, you know, posting swipe up links on Instagram. When we think of an influencer, we think of a stereotypical image of a white woman in kind of lycra leggings, flogging flat tummy tea on Instagram. We think of a Kylie Jenner. But the reality of influencing is a whole lot more diverse than this. There are thinkfluencers, cleaning influencers, legal influencers, farmfluencers who are kind of vlogging from looking after their cattle. You've got LinkedIn influencers. So actually, what I'm trying to argue is that the reason we should care about influence is that actually it goes much beyond those kind of traditional categories of fitness or food or fashion. And actually it's a fundamental shift in the way that power is accumulated, culture is produced and consumed. So I would consider Donald Trump an influencer. I would consider Elon Musk an influencer. And I think everyone to some degree is a creator or an influencer in their own way if they're online in 2022.
Yeah. You're listening to Nightlife with Indira Naidu. And first up, we're talking about the influencer and the influencer culture. My guest is Olivia Yallop. She's a digital strategist and she's written a book called Break the Internet in Pursuit of Influence. She's looked a lot at this issue. So, Olivia, tell us a little bit about the hierarchy of influencer culture. How does one work their way up to become a top-tier influencer and what does that even look like?
Yeah, good question, because traditionally the media tends to cover only the sort of top 1%, the real millionaires and billionaires, the true success stories. But actually, that is quite misrepresentative of the influencer kind of landscape as a whole, because yes, you have those super, super top success stories. You've got, you know, the Ryan Cadges, who's a 7-year-old who unboxes toys on YouTube and made about $29 million last year.
he's
the real... Yeah, real kind of fringe success story. But actually, the kind of vast majority of influencers belong to a slightly more kind of middle class or working class of influencer, where there may be micro influencers or nano influencers. And the way that we would define those varies, according to which country you're in and who you're talking to. But nano influencers may be people with just a few thousand followers. Micro influencers may have a few thousand to a few hundred thousand, and then you really get up to the kind of big leagues with the kind of million plus follower count. And I would also say that it varies according to what platform you're on. So TikTok, there is a kind of an algorithm that gets you a lot more attention than it maybe does on slightly older platforms like Instagram or YouTube. So on TikTok, it's a lot easier to get followers more quickly. It's a lot easier to get views more quickly. So you'll often see a lot more younger people with larger follower counts, whereas on YouTube, to hit that maybe first 1,000, you really need to be grafting and kind of producing high quality content maybe a couple of times a week for maybe the pace of years. So the sort of trajectory is a bit slower on Instagram and YouTube than it would be on TikTok.
Okay, so you've mentioned a little bit there about producing this content quite regularly in terms of how do you become a top tier influencer? Is that what it is? Is just posting a lot of content?
Yes. So it's a kind of the golden question really is how do you become a super, super successful influencer? And I rather unsuccessfully attempted to try to become one myself as part of the research for this book. And let me tell you, it's a lot harder than it appears from the outside. It's definitely not just kind of lazily taking a few pictures of yourself. There is a lot of work that goes into it. I think people don't realize that actually when you're an influencer, what you're doing is you're not kind of getting paid to have fun. Everything that you're doing in your life is now potentially a monetizable activity that can be turned into content.
So it just sounds so exhausting, Olivia.
Yeah, it's a really, really big commitment. A little bit like, I think for listeners who maybe have started working from home during the pandemic, and many people have complained that, you know, working from home is a bit more like living at the office. Well, actually, I would say that's probably more true for influencers who really are kind of, their job is their life and their life is their job. So yeah, they're producing regular content. They are kind of always on the lookout for hacks and tips and tricks for growth and strategies. It's very, very competitive. It's always, always on. And then there's also a little bit of luck involved as well. So you do have these kind of breakthrough success stories who manage to blow up with a single piece of viral content in, you know, the space of weeks or days. But those are really the fringe stories. And most people, although they may appear to be overnight successes and you think, oh, I've never heard of this person, where have they come from? Actually behind them is many, many years of not only creating content, but also consuming it, because you really, really need to be bedded into the kind of current trends and new tips and techniques. You need to be watching everyone else's content, optimizing your own. So it's a very kind of engaged and almost vocational career.
Yeah. And Olivia, I want to ask you a bit later about when you attempted to become an influencer yourself, but I wanted to go back to, you know, these top tier influencers. So someone like Kylie Jenner represents the pinnacle of influencer fame. She's famous for feeling famous and is a top earner on Instagram. What's her sort of endorsement worth for a brand? Give me some figures.
So the this is an interesting one, because there is no official statement of the amount of money that Kylie Jenner would make for a post. However, analytics companies have kind of reverse engineered based on market principles around the kind of average rates that you could get for a post. So the estimation is that Kylie Jenner would make around $1.2 million for a sponsored post, a single sponsored feed post on her Instagram. But I would just point out that that has not been kind of officially ratified as a statistic. But yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, at the kind of lowest end, you'd maybe be posting for free, or, you know, you've in exchange for a kind of discount code, or maybe a few hundred dollars. But then at the top end, you know, you're really negotiating what amount to effectively massive commercial contracts, which are usually not for a single post, but maybe kind of engineered for a series of posts or engagement with the brand over a kind of a few months, or sort of appearing in content more naturally, more organically. Maybe it's a product that's popping up in your vlog, and then later it's in an Instagram story, and then maybe you mention it on Twitter. That kind of relationship is seen to be a bit more mature than and more mature and more effective than the traditional kind of influencer holding a product to camera and saying, oh, wow, this is great.
Yeah. So when you're talking about that sort of earnings and that sort of clout and influence, what sort of regulation and transparency are influencers obliged to, you know, disclose in terms of how much they are being paid?
Also a question, because this is the sort of hot topic within the influencer industry at the moment, is what kind of regulatory structure do we want to introduce for influencers? Who is the best person to regulate influencers as a kind of system? So to give you a bit of context, the first instance of influencers being regulated by anyone happened in the UK with an Oreo campaign. It was a kind of challenge to lick to the middle of an Oreo, you know, those little like circular cookies. And a journalist pulled this up and said, I actually think this is actually not being disclosed as a brand partnership. And that was back in, I think, 2013, 2014. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've seen multiple attempts, usually from advertising industry bodies, to create a regulatory structure. So the rules at the moment vary per country. And in Australia, you guys actually have quite relaxed rules, and you were kind of quite relaxed in your approach to regulating influencers until quite recently. My last understanding of regulation came in 2020, which is now asking people to declare sponsored content with a hashtag ad, but no longer to no need to maybe declare gifted items as gifted. Whereas in the UK, for example, if you've been sent an item for free but you've not been paid to post about it, you have to declare that as well. So there's different rules per country, but mostly it comes around disclosing sponsored partnerships and kind of commercial relationships. There is much less regulation when it comes to the other hot topic, which is what happens when you get kind of children involved in online influencing, and what are the kind of rules and rights do they have around the creation of their content? And, you know, how long are they allowed to work for? And what if they turn around and change their mind and say, oh, you know, I don't want to be part of this family channel. So that's the kind of other flip side of influencer regulation, which is currently being hashed out.
All right. And I want to nut through that as well. But I want to go back to, you mentioned how you attempted to join the influencer universe. How did you do that, and what happened?
So this was a little, it was slightly tongue in cheek. I was hoping to gain a real empathy for what influencers are doing on the daily and hope to kind of write about it as something other than just kind of sitting around lazily taking selfies. So the first thing I did was I enlisted in an influencer boot camp, which is a week-long course that runs every year. There are courses all around the world, but I enlisted in one in London that kind of trains children and teenagers in creating content for YouTube. Wow. So I joined one of those with an amazing class of kind of 7, 8-year-old boys who all wanted to be gaming streamers, you know, people who play video games live online. And I was totally out of my depth because I'm not a gamer. But they were, I was so impressed with the course, how I'd expected it to be maybe to feel a little bit exploitative or for myself to feel uncomfortable about the kind of concept of an influencer training camp in the first place. But they had a great focus on kind of digital citizenship and privacy and how to really protect your on and your offline lives and keep them separate. So that taught me a lot about tips and techniques for kind of optimizing content, how often I should be posting, building up my own personal brand, all things that I'd been kind of aware of from the other side, working as a social media marketing professional, but maybe not experienced firsthand. And then I just started vlogging, which was a lot more difficult than I'd thought. I think maybe I sound quite verbose and like I'm speaking quite easily to you now, but I tell you, it's very difficult to stare down the face of a camera and kind of ad lib or monologue for your audience. And I also booked myself an influencer photographer. So for the kind of top end fashion photographer, fashion influencers or kind of beauty influencers, they often actually don't create their own content. They have an existing relationship with an influencer photographer who gets those gorgeous street style shots you may right. have seen and think, oh, how do they look so great? How do they look so perfect? And I always look a bit crummy. Well, the answer is they have some professional help. So I did a little influencer shoot in London in one of our most Instagrammable streets. And I felt very, very self-conscious, but it was good fun. And posted the pictures online. I unfortunately didn't gain millions of followers and, $1 million contract with Maybelline or anything, but I'm still crossing my fingers.
All right. So, Olivia, what platforms did you decide to use?
So I used YouTube for vlogging. I really wanted to sort of spread myself amongst the kind of key platforms to get a feel for what it was like to be kind of working on the back end of those. So I did YouTube for my vlogs, and it was very, very labor intensive to kind of produce these quite long. 10 minutes is the sort of YouTube algorithmically optimized length. So 10 minutes of a vlog, all nicely edited with music, is quite difficult to produce, once a week. So I did YouTube for vlogging. I did Instagram for pictures. I had some comments from some slightly confused friends and family when I uploaded a beauty tutorial. They were like, we've never seen you do this before. What is this? And then I also went onto TikTok just to try and see if I could get a viral hit, because that's really what TikTok is known for, sending individual videos kind of to the skyrocketing to the sort of millions and millions of views. And the most I managed was about 20,000 views, which I was super, super happy
I'd
with.
I'd be happy with
but
that.
I was really impressed. I was also kind of slightly freaked out. I'm quite a private person. I had all my social media accounts on private prior to embarking on this journey. And thinking that 20,000 people had actually seen something that, you know, I'd produced and put my face in, it felt quite extraordinary. But interestingly, by the standards of the platform, I really achieved nothing more than a sort of marginally successful or kind of averagely successful post. It's by no means was it even a drop in the water of the TikTok pond. So yeah, a really interesting experience.
Wow.
I'd recommend anyone actually just to have a little play around with TikTok. It's good fun, and it definitely kind of opens your eyes to the next generation of influence, and that it's, you know, much faster, much more ephemeral, and in many ways much more demanding than previous generations of influence.
My guest is author Olivia Yallop, and her book is Break the Internet in Pursuit of Influence. We're talking about the influencer culture. You may have, you know, come across their material, but never really been able to, you know, put a name to what it is that they actually do, and some of the concerns around the content that they produce. And that's what we're talking about on Nightlife tonight. So, Olivia, you mentioned before that there are all these youngsters and kids in this digital marketing course. Were their parents there with them? Well, how do they interact?
So due to pandemic related factors, this was originally going to be an in-person course that I was really looking forward to, kind of meeting people face to face and chatting, but it did eventually end up being online. So there weren't any parents present, but there were kind of course leaders who were trained in kind of child protection, and I did feel that it was a very responsibly run course. I really enjoyed engaging with the attendants on the course. I think they were very, very thoughtful and in many ways a lot more wise about the nature of YouTube fame and the operations of social media algorithms than I'd maybe expected them to be. When I'd said to other influencers or people I was interviewing as part of the book that I was actually attending this course, many people said to me, "Oh gosh, you know, that's really inappropriate. That's commodifying childhood. I would never do that for my children, et cetera, et cetera." And so I went into the course thinking, you know, oh, this is going to feel like it's kind of, you know, commercializing childhood or kind of corrupting these lovely young people's hobbies by kind of making them think about, you know, careers and how to make money and how to brand themselves. But actually, I found that when I arrived there, the reality was that these young people arrived to the course on day one with an already intrinsic understanding of themselves as kind of brands and, you know, how they wanted to position themselves. And they kind of arrived with that sort of commercial nuance already baked in. So it was a really kind of I was slightly taken aback by that. There were moments where the course leader was describing to them how YouTubers can make money and how the kind of algorithm works, and they were kind of correcting him and saying, "Oh, actually, no, the algorithm favors this," or actually, you know, "You should try and embed pre-rolls rather than mid-rolls," referring to sort of placing adverts. So I think that really speaks to the way that the next generation has just been brought up online and is so. And the great way that you just put it earlier is so digitally native that actually a lot of these things that maybe feel like they would need to be taught to someone of maybe my generation,
yes,
really come as second nature to them.
Yeah, that is surprising, isn't it, to hear? And in terms of, Olivia, how the regulation, you said they're now working on regulation to protect these children and the huge fortunes that some of them are amassing. How far down the line is that getting?
Well, unfortunately, not that far down the line. It's been a kind of topic that people have been quite reluctant to engage with, or it's been a tricky issue to know how to regulate. So there's almost been a bit of an intellectual exercise that needs to happen first, which is like, do you think influencers are marketing and thus should be regulated by the advertising industry? Actually, I feel like we've probably gone beyond that now, and influencers are maybe more kind of entrepreneurs, and we maybe need to think about them as, I don't know, as entertainers, or that kind of semantic question about where they fit has really been holding up regulation of the influencer industry. So there's been a couple of interesting developments in the past couple of years. So in 2020, there was a big kind of celebration when Hollywood SAG-AFTRA Union, which is the Screenwriters and Artists Guild, so the union that basically regulates kind of workers in the Hollywood entertainment industry, announced that it would be extending its coverage to include TikTokers within that spectrum of people who are considered entertainers or performers or actors. So that means that they can now be part of that union, and they can kind of have some of the protections and the advice that union would provide. So that's one methodology of kind of doing it, which has kind of yet to be used in practice, I think, but is a great step forward. There are also independent kind of vigilante operations that have been set up. So a group of influencers came together to found something called the Influencer Union. And there's one of those in the US and one of those in the UK. They have yet to make any kind of professional steps so far, but they've come together, and I think they're starting kind of steering committees. So that's another potential route, is actually regulation coming from influencers themselves wanting to establish a more fair and equitable system. And then the final thing is actually looking at kind of law and governments as a way of potentially regulating labor conditions. So we've seen in France, a French MP last year has campaigned to include child performers, to include under the definition of child performers, YouTubers and kids, who kid influencers, people who create content as children online, and so they are now considered to be entertainers, and so there are rules about, you know, how long they can work, how much they need to break for, what happens to their education whilst they're working. So that's a great step, but unfortunately that regulation doesn't go so far as to include children who appear in the as kind of background content in family vlogs or mumfluencers.
I wanted to ask you about this, Olivia, because some parents are choosing to include their kids by creating this family content that might contain, you know, very intimate details of their child's, you know, day-to-day activities, and they're called mum influencers or family channels. Now, you spoke to some of these families for your book. What's the draw card for these types of parents?
It's an interesting one. I did speak to a range of mumfluencers from all sorts of kind of economic and social backgrounds, from a kind of teen mum who really saw YouTube as a way of supporting her child and actually creating opportunities for her child that she wouldn't have been able to get any other way. And she spoke really candidly about the kind of opportunities, both financial and kind of cultural, that being on YouTube had given to her and her child. And she had some quite strict rules around what she was going to share and what she wasn't going to share. And then there are kind of, mummy bloggers or mumfluencers, as you say, who kind of write long, long details, you know, whether it's Instagram posts or they tend to kind of accumulate on Instagram, kind of detailing their children's every kind of milestone as they grow up. And the kind of attraction there, I think, is often, I was told, is often kind of a sense of community. There's maybe loneliness when you've just had a child. You want to connect with other mums your age. You want to kind of share both the kind of upsides of having a child, but also the kind of downsides and kind of muddle through problems together. So there are some really, I think, kind of authentic and genuine and honest reasons why you might want to join this mumfluencing community. But there are also obviously some kind of slightly more cynical motivations, like you can make a lot of money off it. It's potentially perceived to be quite a sort of glamorous career. You get sent lots of free stuff. There are those kind of slightly more shallow and superficial things, which I'm sure, you know, play in some way. But I was really kind of inspired speaking to these women about how much the community had actually brought to them that was positive. Of course, there are also negatives. You know, opening up your kind of parenting to the whole internet can obviously cause a lot of kind of stress on the family. It can cause stress on the child. Your child could later turn around and say, oh, actually, I don't want to be part of this. And there are instances in which children have been documented to turn around and say, actually, I really don't want to be part of this. And that's maybe caused some friction. So there was an infamous post on the social networking site Reddit, which is an anonymous forum for those who aren't familiar with the platform, where someone who was claiming to be the child of an influencer posted saying, I have got some hoodies printed that say things like, don't take my picture, I don't give my permission, and I'm going to give them to me and my sister to wear because we are sick of being part of our mum's content. We begged her to stop. She won't. She, you know, posts about us from day to night. I'm really embarrassed. She overshares. She, you know, digs through my personal life and shares it all with her Instagram followers. And they were really, really upset about that. And there wasn't necessarily a way that they could combat that. So they resorted to quite a grassroots method of just printing and wearing these hoodies with these slogans emblazoned on them. And they were asking for help on Reddit as to what they could kind of do. And there were lots of people expressing their sympathies. So yeah, it's not always kind of smooth sailing. And then there is a sort of dark side to this where family YouTube channels have, in the most extreme cases, actually the children have been kind of convicted for child abuse or child neglect. For doing things like, you know, pranking their children or exposing, you know, continually putting videos of their kind of crying children online. And that is really a very, very sad and very, very dark aspect of this, which I don't like to dwell on too long because I think it maybe doesn't represent the whole spectrum of influencing and definitely doesn't represent the views or the kind of motivations of the majority of people who are working in this space.
And sort of policing that, is that part of this legislation in France?
Yeah, so the policing of the regulation in France extends to, as far as I'm aware, just kid influencers themselves. So that would be an instance like Ryan Kadji, who's kind of effectively, in quote marks, running his own channel. He is the star, but doesn't necessarily extend to the offspring of mumfluencers who say that they run the account. So there's a there's a bit of a legal grey area there. And there's definitely some need for tighter regulations around the role of children, and I think if you look at the way that the more traditional forms of media and entertainment have operated, for example, how children participate in online in on stage musicals, or you know, you have children in ballets sometimes. There are obviously great regulations around child performers there, and how long they can be on stage, and the sort of safety networks they need to have, and to make sure that they're not missing out on other kind of life experiences, and to make sure that they're happy and looked after. And it would be great if we could apply some of those frameworks, I think, to the digital industry. The problem is that it's just all so new, and it's all happening so quickly that I really do feel for those trying to regulate, that it's very, very difficult to try and keep up.
Yeah. You're with Indira and I Do on Nightlife. And my guest is Olivia Yallop. She's written a book called Break the Internet in Pursuit of Influence. We're talking about the influencer culture. Lots of concerning elements in there. And if you're listening and you haven't really been aware of just how widespread and influential influencers have become, I guess you're getting a sense of it from our conversation with Olivia. You say, Olivia, that you're critical of the fact that the mainstream media has to date not really paid much attention to influencers, and given their growth and their reach. Why do you think that is, that the traditional media just hasn't been giving them much attention?
It's an interesting question, and I think I would refer to actually the words of a really big fashion and beauty influencer in the UK who I interviewed for the book, who was quite blunt about it, and she said, I think the reason that, you know, you browse down the sidebar of the Daily Mail, which I know you have in the US, in Australia, mm. same as in the UK, you browse down the Daily Mail's sidebar of shame, and you see tons of information about reality TV stars, about all sorts of kind of sort of minor cultural celebrities, but you never see anything about influencers. And she said, I think the reason that this is the case is because they feel threatened by us. Mainstream media has traditionally had a kind of reciprocal relationship with lifestyle celebrities or reality stars or that kind of breed of person for a very, very long time. There's been a relationship between kind of tabloids, paparazzi, newspapers, individuals that's kind of worked to mutually boost everyone's careers and to help really prop up the kind of revenues of outlets like the Daily Mail. And she was saying, you know, digital influencers feel like a threat to that because these magazines and newspapers haven't had any hand in kind of helping our success. They haven't had any say in how we've kind of been portrayed, and they feel threatened by the digital industry as a whole because of the attrition of more traditional print and kind of network news systems by digital media as a whole. So there's a slightly kind of as she sees it, antagonistic relationship. I would also say that influencers, that both works both ways, because often you see influencers, or you'll hear influencers rather, talk about how the mainstream media, they always kind of invoke it as MSM or this sort of monolithic idea of a mainstream media, which, as you know, it really is not the case, that they see mainstream media as kind of backwards, outdated, often biased. There's often a kind of narrative that digital influencers or digital forms of media are more authentic, they're more immediate, it's free from the influence of kind of gatekeepers or editors or people who might be trying to kind of distort a message. So I think there's a little bit to say on both sides as to why there hasn't been too much collaboration between mainstream and digital forms of celebrity or media.
And Olivia, one of the more bizarre trends to emerge from influencer culture are these hype houses. Now, can you explain what these are and how it works?
I absolutely can. So a little bit of sad news first. I was actually supposed to go and stay in a hype house in LA, but the pandemic really, really quashed that dream. So I'm still on the lookout and I'm still hoping to stay in one. But for the uninitiated, what is a hype house? It sounds kind of crazy, and it is kind of crazy. A hype house is the name, a kind of colloquial name given to a content house, which is an arrangement whereby lots of influencers, often in the same kind of genre or the same kind of space in the industry, all decide to come and live together. They mutually rent a big sort of splashy mansion, whether that might be in the kind of Hollywood Hills in LA. I know you've also had some in kind of Sydney as well. where they are coming together, they're living together 24/7, they are creating content with each other, about each other, from the house, and often the house is kind of given a nickname, and they often have a kind of group house account as well. And the idea is that by living and working together, they can, it's almost like a sort of 24/7 reality TV show that you can kind of dip in and out of via social.
So how many of these hype houses would be going on right now?
So, well, they really exploded during the pandemic, I think, as influencers realized that this was quite a good way. You know, if you have to stay at home, why not stay at home with a whole load of other people? Because you can also kind of collaborate and build your careers and keep working, which obviously, if you're kind of stuck on your own in your bedroom, often you can't. So it's worth saying that the first, the earliest kind of recorded instances of hype houses or content houses, as they were called at the time, is really in the early 2010s, when it was a sort of mutually convenient relationship just for influencers who were maybe moving to a new area together to kind of start living together. And then it sort of, the idea sort of spiraled, and you got YouTube collectives and groups wanting to move in together because it was beneficial for their kind of careers, beneficial for their business relationship. And then the term hype house really came about in 2020, late 2019, early 2020, when the Hype House, eponymous Hype House, came together, which was a big group of TikTok's biggest stars. That's like the Charli D'Amelios, Addison Rae's, Chase Hudson. They all came together and started living under one roof in a big old McMansion in the Hollywood Hills. And then in the months after that, I would say it exploded to around sort of 30 or 40 worldwide. Gosh. And the number is still kind of growing, and they tend to operate on a sort of seasonal basis. So they kind of spring up and die off as people sort of move in or move out, and people, you know, fall out, and they can be a bit kind of tempestuous or chaotic on the inside. So as you can imagine, if you stick, you know, loads of
I've seen millionaires together. I've seen a couple of episodes of Big Brother, and it just sounds like an out of control Big Brother. Right. Isn't that extraordinary? That's very new to me. The other thing I wanted to explore, Olivia, is the longevity in this sector. How long are people influencers for?
Really good question. We haven't actually seen the tail end of influencing because it's a relatively new occupation. There are still influencers kicking around who were there in the early days of MySpace, the early days of YouTube. They're kind of few and far between. I would point to people like the Green brothers, Hank and John Green, who are YouTube vloggers who really kind of pioneered the vlogging format. There are sort of slightly unfortunate figures like Jeffree Star, who's a controversial YouTube beauty guru who began his career on MySpace and is still one of the biggest influencers today, you know, sort of 15, 20 years later. He's not a great advertisement for kind of longevity within influencing. For anyone who doesn't know him, he's been caught up in many a controversy. But what is interesting, I think, is that although there are these kind of long-term, almost sort of career influencers, what you more likely see is actually influencing being quite cyclical as people kind of rise up. They hit their kind of maturity phase, then they start to kind of peter out. Maybe their audience grows up, has grown up with them, and maybe is interested in different things. Maybe they actually burn out or they tire of creating content within their genre, because it's quite a full-on occupation, as we've discussed. And if you've been creating beauty content for 10 years, you might just think, God, I've had enough. And so you often see influencers diversify into new genres. So maybe someone who grew up being a beauty guru, like Zoella, a big kind of famous British beauty vlogger. She started being a beauty influencer, and then as she grew up, her fan base matured, she evolved into doing home and lifestyle content about her pets, cooking, that kind of thing. So her interest kind of matured as she did. And then also you see a significant amount of people who drop off or kind of burn out, who say, you know, I'm actually done with my career as an influencer. I'm going to step out. I'm going to move into kind of maybe an advisory job, or I'm going to retrain. I've met ex-influencers who are now training as lawyers or kind of interior designers, or many that are actually working in the kind of branding, advertising and marketing space, or the digital space, because they obviously have such an intuitive understanding of the way that it all operates.
So Olivia, what are some of the ways you expect brands are going to harness these influencers in the near future that we haven't seen yet?
It's an interesting point, because I have a kind of grand unified theory of influence, which is that influencers really began as an advertising accessory. They were used as kind of human billboards.
Exactly, because this is what I remember as a kid, you know, when we were in school trying to get those first jobs. I remember a friend of ours at school who got a job standing in front of a shop wearing those placards, you know, on either sandwich boards. And we all went along after school one day and it was awful and made jokes and stared and made call her names and things. Yeah. And it was such a humiliating job to have to do. And now really that was the beginning of influencers in a way, wasn't it?
Yes, that's actually a fantastic. I haven't heard that that connection made before, but actually that's a very, very accurate one. That it was something that would be a kind of source of ritual humiliation has now become pretty dares. So I would say that although influencers began as kind of as really an advertising industry accessory, in that they were part of social media, which was part of digital, which was part of marketing, which was then part of advertising, they were almost kind of quite far down this kind of spectrum. And they were really viewed as, you know, just a media channel like any other, like radio, like TV. You would book a slot, you would pay, you would send them a product, they would post a little advert. And I think actually we've moved beyond that. We're now in kind of phase 2.0, where influencers have really realized that they don't necessarily need to flog things for brands. They are the brand themselves. And actually audiences are invested in them. And so what they're doing now is actually making money by selling their own merchandise, by starting brands themselves that often actually rival or kind of cut out the brands that they were originally advertising right. for. So it's been a really interesting kind of pivot in that you're seeing, you know, a lot of those original beauty brands or fashion brands are losing out to these kind of entrepreneurs or these self-funded brands, and the influencers have begun to start themselves.
Oh, which reminds me, because there was this case of some high-profile person, I can't remember now, who tweaked a shoe brand and created his own brand with it, and then there was some legal action taken against him because he included some human blood or something in it. Do you know that story?
Oh yes, yeah. This is So this is if you would like to hear about this, it's Lil Nas X is a rapper from the US, and he worked with an experimental art collective known as Mischief. They do kind of funny viral stunts on the internet, and Lil Nas X's kind of personal brand is all about doing sort of funny viral meme content. Mm. So he made a pair of Nikes that had a drop of his blood in them to kind of poke back at detractors in the US who were saying that he was kind of sinful because he's black and gay and raps about being black and gay and had a bit of a backlash from that. Interesting instance. Although that wasn't necessarily available to for followers to buy, whereas for example, many influencers now have shoe brands of their own, they have beauty brands of their own, they have fashion lines, they have, you know, their own lines of tech equipment, or, you know, anything that you could possibly think of, notebooks, mugs. It really goes super, super far. And so that actually, I think many people are under the kind of illusion that influencers make most of their money through advertising, whereas actually these kind of individual enterprises can often end up being way, way, way more lucrative than the potential advertising revenue.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And Olivia, coming back to us, the audience, the consumers of this content that the influencers create, how do we benefit from it? I mean, can we trust what they say, given that they're doing it for money, for fame, for profile, for whatever? I mean, what do we get out of it?
I think it's interesting, what we get out of influencers, the reason that kind of influencers emerged in the first place, it's due to a combination of factors, but I really do feel that there was some kind of frustration with existing forms of media, that maybe they weren't kind of immediate enough, or they weren't kind of human enough. And what influencers were really able to do in the early 2010s very, very successfully was create a kind of personal connection to their viewer that magazines, television, newspapers couldn't possibly do. That, I mean, the format just didn't really allow them to do so. So what originally kind of attracted people to influencers en masse is this feeling of immediacy, this feeling of connection, the fact that I can see this person who is effectively a celebrity and I can DM them and say, oh, hey, I really like that. What do you think? And they'll respond. So there's this kind of immediate connection that was totally missing with, you know, any other form of celebrity. You could never DM, you know, like Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie back in the 90s and say, oh, hi, what do you think about this? They obviously, that would never be the case. So there was this kind of immediacy and human connection, known professionally as a kind of parasocial relationship. That's the term that academics would give to that kind of relationship being formed between a massive audience and an individual influencer that feels very, very personal and very intimate, although actually, you know, the individual really has no idea who you are. You're just kind of one of many followers.
And they're probably not even writing it.
Well, in some cases they are, in some cases they aren't. I do know influencers at the kind of really top level who do have social media managers, because, you know, at that level, once they get there, you know, they're entrepreneurs, they're CEOs, they're running brands, they're, you know, they're really doing, you know, they're really a celebrity. So yeah, a bit like traditional celebrities, they have someone to sort of check their DMs and do the responses. But in many cases, you know, influencers really are the ones behind them, and they are, you know, correspondingly glued to their phones 24/7. But yeah, I think that feeling of human connection is really what has powered influencers and has made them so effective and so successful.
Yes. Olivia, now to the influencers, the ones you know, the ones you've met, do they enjoy what they do? Do they like it?
It's a mixed bag. Many of them do. I think the way that it's been described to me is kind of hyper freelancing. So if you're not familiar with why anyone would want to be an influencer, but you kind of maybe work for yourself or you've spent some time freelancing, I think a good way to think about it is like it's freelancing on stilts. You're kind of freelancing just as your identity, as your personality. That is your kind of career. So I think a lot of them have said that they love it for, you know, the following reasons. It's given them an incredible amount of freedom, of flexibility. They can work when they want, they can do what they want. They feel very empowered by being able to work for themselves and being able to kind of work for these brands and kind of make their money their own way rather than working in a more traditional formal employment structure. And also the kind of opportunities that influencing can give you are, you know, really quite serious. I mean, I know of other people my age who you know have bought big houses or have been able to, you know, pay off debts, or there are amazing kind of economic and cultural and social opportunities that being an influencer does give you, an amazing lifestyle, all that sort of thing. But I would say there are also some real kind of drawbacks that I think it's important to mention for anyone, you know, interested in a career as an influencer or maybe thinking that influencing just seems like having a bit of fun. There are obvious kind of burnout and stress related implications. There is trolling and harassment. The implication of being online all the time for your mental health is pretty serious. I think you don't feel like you can ever really switch off, because you're in constant competition, not only with yourself to kind of get more followers, more likes, to keep growing upwards, but also with all of your peers, your friends, other people who you're friends with in the influencer industry. You're also competing with for likes, for views, for attention, for contracts. So it can be a kind of very sort of strange set of social structures that you find yourself in. And it can be, you know, when it's bad, it can be quite bad. And there are many, many instances online of really top YouTubers coming out and saying, I've had to take a break from my mental health, or often kind of saying, you know, I'm finding this really stressful. I think Charli D'Amelio, who's one of the biggest TikTokers, was actually crying in a vlog last year and saying, oh, I just don't want to do this anymore. I feel like everyone, you know, I feel so watched all the time. And of course, you know, feeling like whether you can actually move out of influencing is a whole other topic. Many people feel like they, you know, having been an influencer and been someone who's very, very public and very, very visible, that there are many things now that they can't do with their life because they have shared so much online. And so actually like stepping back from being a public figure is a whole other issue in itself. So yeah, it's a mixed bag. But I will say that there are a lot of really, really vocal supporters for it as a kind of new way of making money and a new way of kind of hustling to work without feeling like you're kind of being put upon.
Yeah. I mean, look, as someone of my particular vintage and, you know, my background in sort of mainstream traditional broadcasting, and it just sounds like a real nightmare to actually be involved in it. It's interesting, isn't it?
I'm sure we could get you on TikTok. I'm sure we could.
Oh, yeah, if I can move my old bones. Yeah.
You have a sort of on and an off state, I guess, which influencers don't really, in that you have a sort of line between your public persona or your kind of professional persona and then when you're kind of off the clock, so to speak, which isn't really the case when you're an influencer.
Yeah. Olivia, absolutely fascinating. A really terrific chat, and congratulations on the book, and thank you for just giving us such a thorough sort of examination of influencers and all the challenges around it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Olivia Yallop, who is the author of Break the Internet in Pursuit of Influence. She's a digital strategist. And as you can hear from our conversation, making a lot of money for a lot of people, particularly a lot of young people, children. And it is speeding along at a rate that the regulators really can't keep up with it. So it's going to be an interesting space to watch.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.